last word on the environment on Today FM.
With ESB Networks, connecting you to a clean electric future. ESBnetworks.ie.
We're now joined by John Gibbons, environmental commentator. John, we're going to begin by this new government report in the UK that found that octopuses, crabs and lobsters are capable of experiencing pain and they are deemed to be sentient beings. What's the story?
Good evening, Donald. Yeah, it's quite interesting. I suppose it's not a specific report, but rather it's the UK government are moving towards legislation, really animal welfare legislation across the board. And part of that has been collating reports from various scientific agencies to look at this, how much, to what extent various animals are capable of experiencing, I suppose, pain, anxiety, and so on, the kind of things that we normally associate with vertebrates like ourselves and fish and so on. And what's come out of it that's quite surprising, I guess, is that two categories, one called decapod crustaceans, which we would call shrimps, crabs, and lobsters, and the other cephalopods, mollusks, which would be octopus and squid, these have turned out to have highly complex brains and nervous systems. So, for example, they found that crustaceans have what are called opioid receptors, and essentially that means that they respond to painkillers, for example, in more or less exactly the same way that a human responds to painkillers. In other words, they experience pain broadly the same way that we experience pain. And I guess this is important because at the moment, for example, chefs around the country are taking lobsters out of tanks and dropping them live into boiling water. So they're basically boiling them alive. And that would suggest, this research says very strongly that these animals are therefore put through extreme suffering. And the move in the UK, Daniel, is to move away from this and basically to raise awareness that these animals are as capable as you and I of suffering extreme pain and distress.
As an island nation, we obviously love our seafood, and you go to, you know, if you go on your holidays down to West Cork and elsewhere, you know, you're going to be dining on some of the best crabs, lobsters and everything else. What sort of ramifications could there be for, say, a practicing chef? Like, what are the alternatives, I suppose, in dealing with these animals in a more humane way?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Well, first of all, the alternative is before you put a lobster into boiling water, which is part of the cooking, you kill it. So you basically, there's a method for puncturing the spinal column and the brain of a lobster before it goes into the pot. It has absolutely no effect whatsoever on the cooking process. There are kind of myths that you have to cook them alive. That's just the way it's been done over time. But we now know for certain that these animals, as I said, their experience of pain and their experience of trauma is very, very similar to ourselves. And we see that, Daniel, right across the animal kingdom. And I think people who may have seen, for example, the Netflix documentary, My Octopus Teacher, will understand that creatures that look nothing like us, that, for example, don't have spinal columns, that are organized differently, are still capable of really extraordinary higher reasoning. And that documentary, for example, followed this particular octopus, and one of its strategies for avoiding being eaten by sharks was to pick up shells from other creatures and basically create an armored pod around itself. Now, what they found is that octopus and similar creatures are capable of what we call higher reasoning. They're problem-solving animals that, just like us, they're adapting to their circumstances, they're using intelligence, they're tool users, for example, they're able to solve problems. And once we understand that and appreciate that about our fellow creatures, then what that really does is raise the bar to say, how are we treating them? Is there a cruelty involved? And, you know, one that would spring to mind in my case, for example, would say here in Ireland, would be hare coursing. We know, for example, that hares are nominally a protected species in Ireland, and yet we're allowing, under license, hares to be captured in the wild, held against their will, chased by greyhounds, terrorized, then released back into the wild in a state of who knows what kind of trauma. Okay. And, for example, the ISPCA, the anti-cruelty organization, that they've called for a full ban.
Okay.
And we see this right across the board, Daniel.
I just want, obviously this is a UK move or UK government move. Is there any signal as to whether or not there'll be a similar move here?
Nothing so far, no. Okay. But I do think, and it is quite interesting that the UK government has actually said that leaving, this is one of those weird Brexit ironies, they've said that leaving the European Union is allowing them in some cases to implement higher animal welfare standards than are possible in the European Union. And I'll give you an example. The UK is also moving towards the banning of live exports. And they've basically said that this is, again, an inhumane thing. And some of your listeners may recall that last March, the Suez Canal was blocked for a couple of weeks by a large ship. Mm. Now, during that period, around 200,000 livestock died of thirst and starvation, probably the most horrible deaths imaginable, on ships that were trapped in the Suez Canal. And it really drove home the fact that we have millions of livestock that have been shipped around the world, including, I should say, from Ireland. We're a large exporter of live animals. And probably in terms, if you accept that animals are sentient and capable of experiencing fear and distress and so on, quite similar to the way we are, then you probably, for example, wouldn't put unweaned calves aged 15 to 21 days old onto a ship and then ship that ship off to either France or the Middle East.
You have a point there, but I'm sure you'd meet a pretty sizable lobby from the industry and from farmers across the country saying that you've just, you know, in a heartbeat, wished away their industry and their livelihoods.
Well, I wouldn't think anyone's wishing away an industry, but would you really want an industry based on deliberately causing distress and extreme hardship if you know for certain that these animals are capable of it? Mm-hmm. And for example, I was reading a Chagas study on this earlier, and they were talking about in relation to the castration of bull calves, and they point out that the process causes a degree of pain and stress and elicits a psychological stress, including pain-associated behaviours, suppression of immune function. So we know, this isn't my opinion, we know that we're dealing with sentient animals. Okay. Now, it means we have to look for higher standards. And for example, live exports, in my opinion, and I should say in the opinion of experts like the ISPCA, has no role in a humane society.
Okay, I want to move on. I want to look at this, I suppose it's a brewing row within government, that you have Fine Gael Senator Regina Doherty and Fianna Fáil Senator Robbie Gallagher looking for a derogation to peat producers, but they're being opposed by their Green Party colleague Pauline O'Reilly. What's the story?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. What Regina Doherty and Robbie Gallagher in the Senate are basically saying is that they want what they call a temporary derogation to allow, they claim that it's to allow the horticulture industry to get enough peat to stay in business. Now, it's a very strange claim. As you say, Pauline O'Reilly of the Greens has pointed out that the bill they're proposing is simply illegal. It's not compatible with EU law. Now, I suspect, and you may have your own guide on this, but I suspect that this is really a political stunt to try and both play for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. They're playing to a certain rural Ireland lobby here. The likelihood is that this is impossible to achieve. Now, what's really important, Daniel, to stress here is that they claim that the reason for this bill is to protect horticulture producers right here in Ireland. So, for example, people like mushroom farmers. Now, we know, for example, that right now Ireland is exporting 10 times more peat, is being cut and exported, about 500,000 tons a year, than is needed for our entire horticulture industry. So claiming that we have to continue to legalise this to support the horticulture industry is a red herring. It's nothing more than a cover story. And it is a very strange thing, because if we allow this bill to go forward, it would also mean wide-scale bog cutting being carried out without environmental impact assessment. And I think politically this is really interesting. I don't know if people in Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil remember, but 2 weeks ago, We had the COP conference in Glasgow, where nations of the world, including Micheál Martin, went over there and said, we're all acting together to protect biodiversity, to protect climate. And to have government parties within a couple of weeks of this come back here and propose this, it makes a mockery of any attempt on Ireland's part to achieve either our climate or our emissions targets. Because there is no more effective way of releasing carbon into the atmosphere and damaging biodiversity than bog cutting. Yeah, it's a fantastically inefficient way of either generating product or otherwise. Yeah,
sorry. I see those, like the Robbie Gallagher and Regina Doherty, you know, that they're raising this on because they say they're concerned at the risk to jobs in the transition period where there are no alternatives present, and particularly for the mushroom industry, as you highlighted earlier on. Is that not a legitimate, like, I mean, obviously there needs to be a transition, but is it not a legitimate claim to say that let us have a derogation while that transition takes place?
This bill is simply cover for a group of companies that are cutting peat without license, by the way, at the moment. The only company in the country that has an EPA license to commercially extract peat is Bord na Mona. All these other companies are operating at the margins, I use my words carefully, at the margins of the law at best, and there have been numerous high court cases about this. Now, it appears that this bill is an attempt to legalise illegal practice. There is no grounds for it environmentally. The peat industry, we've seen, for example, other countries have already introduced, Britain, for example, has introduced a ban on peat for horticultural purposes entirely. We need to move in that direction. But I'd stress this, Daniel, the purpose of this bill is a cover story to allow these peat companies to continue not to provide the horticultural peat for Ireland. That's only a small part of their business. Their big business is shipping 500,000 tons and more a year of this peat abroad. And it's a trade that needs to stop because it's got no future.
And just on that, how successful do you reckon the Greens have been in government in I suppose, forcing change? Because obviously the climate bill earlier this year was seen as a red letter day for them in government. But given these sort of rows, I mean, how successful from your perspective, from the environmental perspective, have the Green Party been?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tough one. Well, first of all, obviously, they only represent 12 seats in a government of whatever it is, 85, 90. So I think many, what you might call purists, are angry with the Green Party that they haven't delivered everything. I would try to take a more pragmatic view and look at the things they have achieved. For example, they managed a ban on fur farming earlier this year, which ties into with my earlier item on animal cruelty. That was a big success from their point of view. Okay. And in relation to this, Daniel, I suppose without the Greens in government, then the likelihood is that something like this could actually slip through. So at least they're there to alert us to some of the crazier ideas that get pushed by senators who are looking for publicity.
And literally, we've got 30 seconds left. Our final item, the Arctic Ocean is warming quickly. And this is on foot of warmer waters from the Atlantic Ocean. What can you tell us?
Yeah, that's part of it, Daniel. It's a process called Atlantification. This basically means warmer and saltier waters are mixing from the North Atlantic into the Arctic Ocean. And this is bad news all around. We know already that the Arctic is warming three times more quickly than the planet as a whole. Temperatures in the region have already risen by more than 3 degrees centigrade. This is a real red letter issue. We're losing sea cover, sea ice cover in the Arctic at a rapid rate. And the implications for global warming of this are just bad all the way, I'm afraid.
And basically, it's heating up the water three times faster than the rest of the world, with, obviously, you say, major implications. We'll have to leave it there. John Gibbons, it's been fascinating talking to you, environmental commentator. We'll leave it there for now. Thank you very much for joining us on The Last Word.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
Weekdays from 4:30. Today FM.